This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, American Chinatowns empty out as residents are lured back to the People's Republic. Also, why to be wary of campaign polls. And our series on mental illness in teens continues with cultural stigmas against modern medical treatments. But we begin with our ongoing 11 for 11 series of conversations with innovative thinkers on the big issues of our time. Today, Dr. Raymond Tallis attacks the notion of biological determinism. We've reported a number of developments on human hardwiring, from how our genetics affect shopping habits to predicting criminal activity based on brain scans. That's what made Dr. Tallis's argument so provocative. In a new book called Aping Mankind, he targets what he calls neurotrash, the explosion of pseudoscience that explains human behavior from believing in God to falling in love in purely biological terms. Tallis, a former clinical neuroscientist who devoted years to studying stroke and epilepsy, considers such claims to be evidence of Darwinitis and neuromania, which he finds ultimately pessimistic. We spoke with him from the BBC studios in London. Dr. Tallis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be with you.
You're up against a few very big targets here, what you call Darwinization and neuromania. First, define those terms for us.
Neuromania is the belief that the mind is identical with the brain, as a result of which, if you want to understand us, we people, then you just peer into the brain with all sorts of clever technology. Darwinitis says not only does Darwinism explain the organism Homo sapiens, but it also explains what people are now. So you should say that most things we do relate to the desire to reproduce or to survive. And I disagree profoundly with the idea that if you really want to understand us, you can look sideways at, for example, chimpanzees and so on.
And both of these fall into a kind of what you call pessimistic biologism. You know, we are our brains. We can only be understood through our brains, that computer ticking off inside of us.
Indeed, that essentially we are organisms, and we're organisms like other inhabitants of the animal kingdom, and that if you want to understand human beings, you need to look at the biological script that we are fated to follow. And I don't believe that at all. I think human beings have actually escaped to some extent from biology, and we're writing our own script collectively. And it is almost routine now for people to say, I am my brain, or I am essentially the same as a beast. And if you want to explain why I behave badly, then look to the Darwinian imperative to support survival or whatever. And it is becoming increasingly common, not only in academe, but indeed in popular thought, to think about ourselves in evolutionary and neuroscientific terms.
You write in the book about, you know, this is metastasizing in labs. There's this sense of danger. What's the danger?
The danger is if we think we are beasts, then we'll think less of each other. And if we think less of each other, we'll treat each other worse. And if we think we're beasts and are, as it were, fated by our biological prescription, we'll give up on trying to improve the world in which we live. And that's fine if you're in a very comfortable position, as I am, but not so fine if you're in a very uncomfortable position, as many people in the world are. And one of my main targets is a political philosopher, John Gray, who thinks that every attempt to improve the lot of mankind is going to come unstuck, and that it'll all end in tears because we fail to recognize that we are animals and that we really are not in control of our fate. And I think that's great if you're a professor of philosophy, not so good if you're a child in the dust.
I must say that we on this program have done a number of stories on advances in neuroscience and connections between the emotions and brain activity, for example. Are we caught up in this, what you call the glamour of science? Why is everybody so swayed by these stories?
I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, first of all, all my research was in neuroscience and in stroke and epilepsy, so I know that of which I speak, if you see what I mean. And I'm aware that having a brain in good working order is a necessary condition of ordinary consciousness and everyday life. But it doesn't mean to say that we are a brain in good working order. And that's the first point. The second point is that we're having great difficulty in explaining in neurological terms even simple things like vision. Why on earth do we think we can explain more complex things like love, wisdom, or economic decision-making? And it seems to me at the moment people feel that by looking at brain scans you can understand the basis of all those much more complex psychosocial things. And I think it's not only premature, I think it's deeply misconceived.
So we read about love as actually neurons firing somewhere in the caudate nucleus or someplace in the brain, right?
In the cingulate gyrus, but bilaterally, you'll be glad to know. But it seems to me that you've got to look at what love is, and you've got to look at what the experiments that have investigated love are. Well, hang on a moment. Love isn't a response to a stimulus. It isn't even a state like being warm or cold. It's lots of things, and one would have to be a Martian not to recognize that love is about awe, guilt, jealousy, narrating the other person, being narrated by the other person, not being in love with that moment, and so on. So the concept of love that neuroscientists of love mobilize, it reduces it to the response to a stimulus. And if they'd read a book, or even a crayoning book, they would have realized that love is rather more complex. It's a many splendid and many miseried thing, which can't be captured in a response to a stimulus.
You mentioned a former clinical neuroscientist. You spent years studying stroke and epilepsy. And you've used fMRI, this brain imaging technology, yourself. So what did you come away with when you were studying those afflictions?
Well, fMRI is fantastic. It shows us precisely the nature of brain damage. It shows us the processes that take place when the brain is recovering from damage. And my own area of interest was in weakness, paralysis. And you can see what happens to the brain in the process of people recovering from paralysis and so on. But that's rather different from falling in love or being wise or making economic decisions. They relate much more to the community of minds in which we live, which can't be discovered by peering into the intracranial darkness where you find an isolated brain. What it means when I fall in love is not just what's happening in my left hemisphere, it's what's happening in the community of minds that is the human world. If we take very simple consciousness, like just being aware of a glass in front of me, some object, clearly there are events in the brain that correlate with my awareness of a particular object in front of me. It doesn't mean to say my awareness is identical with that neural activity. What it means is that neural activity is a necessary condition of my having awareness, but it isn't identical with awareness. So having a brain in good working order is an absolutely necessary condition of my being a human being in the normal sense of the word, but it doesn't mean to say that it is what it is to be a human being. And those who try to identify love and wisdom and economic decision-making with what happens in the brain are making the mistake of confusing necessary and sufficient conditions.
We're speaking with Ray Tallis. He's a former neuroscientist and has taken on some big philosophical and scientific topics in previous books like The Kingdom of Infinite Space and Enemies of Hope. We're talking about his new book called Aping Mankind, and he's combating two big ideas, what he calls neuromania, which is the idea that we are our brains, and that's really the extent of it, and also Darwinitis. Trace that distinction between Darwinism and Darwinitis for us.
Certainly. Darwinism, with which I completely concur, is a theory that explains how the organism Homo sapiens arose. But Darwinitis said this explains what people are now. To me, there's not only a great visible difference between life in the jungle and life in the office, but that difference actually is a profound difference. Most of the frameworks of ordinary everyday activity are completely unknown to animals. Just nipping out to the supermarket to buy a can of beans has 1,000 frames of reference that make sense of it that are simply unknown, even to our nearest so-called kin in the chimpanzees and so on.
From a scientific perspective, is there no value in understanding what happens when our bodies get distressed like that, especially in terms of treatment of stress-related diseases, for example?
Well, I think it's useful to know that when you're stressed, you raise your cortisol and that can impair your immune system and so on and so forth. But when it comes to treating stress, one of the ways is to, say, talk it through, to suggest you may have a job that is less stressful, to speak to your boss who is bullying you or whatever. All of those things are quite unlike animal behavior.
What, to your mind, Dr. Tallis, gets missed when we take that perspective?
The fact that we're explicit and conscious animals, that we do things deliberately for reasons that we largely know, that we do these things in the context of all sorts of frameworks that make sense of them. For example, I've come down to London today because I'm aware that I'm going to have the privilege of talking to your good self, and the reason I want to do this is because I would like to share my ideas and so on and so forth. And this is pretty normal human behaviour. It has got absolutely nothing to do with animal behaviour. And it's interesting to see why people don't observe what's in front of their noses, because you can see this and I can see this. So why do they not see it? I think people feel that if they set aside supernatural explanations of what it is to be a human being, then they have to have entirely naturalistic or biological explanations of what it is to be a human being. And I think one can set aside the first without necessarily embracing the second.
Well, you call it pessimistic biologism. Doesn't the idea of being biologically bound offer some hope for people, for instance, who suffer from mental illnesses, that they know that it is not a spiritual or moral failing on their part, but there is something with their brain that can be healed?
I think that's a really good point. It seems to me that when understanding mental illness, we have to see that it's got two facets. Clearly, there are differences in the brain in people who have schizophrenia. But that's not the end of the story. The person with schizophrenia very poignantly tries to make sense of what their brain is telling them. So the symptoms of schizophrenia are very personal. So to reduce schizophrenia to dysfunction of the brain doesn't do justice, if you like, to the heroism of a person with schizophrenia who is trying to make sense of the world despite what's happening. But the abnormality in the brain certainly is the underlying problem with schizophrenia. So you're quite right, the biological approach to mental disease is actually quite optimistic, so long as we don't reduce mental disease simply to its biological basis. And that's true on a broader front. We clearly have biological roots, we human beings. Most of the functions that I perform from day to day, whether it's, you know, eating or defecating or breathing and so on, clearly are biological. But that's not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story. Biological dysfunction of the brain is the beginning of the story. And when one respects the individual who suffers from schizophrenia, it's acknowledging that they clearly have this problem, which has a biological origin, but they themselves heroically are trying to make sense of it.
Well, we're going to take a short break and come back with Ray Tallis, author of Aping Mankind, which takes aim at the assertion of biological destiny backed up by brain science and minimizing differences between humans and our animal kin, clawing our way up the evolutionary ladder. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.